You're listening to the Myth Korean Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Mike Hernandez, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake.
Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Kathy Ferguson, a professor of political theory in Star Trek.
This is the Myth Korean Podcast. I'm Chris, and with me are...
Mike.
And...
Oren.
And this time, I'm sorry, guys. I know that we've been good friends for a while, but now I'm your enemy.
Ah!
No!
Curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal!
The question is, does my dramatic character change come off as realistic?
Nope.
Or not?
I'm not convinced.
No?
I totally buy it. Chris has been pretty shifty for, like, this entire podcast run. Like, that makes sense to me. I accept it.
Excellent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, you've convinced half your audience. 50% success rate.
I'll take it.
I think that's an E failing grade.
So today we're talking about characters who either switch from good to bad or bad to good. And of course, these are very, very broad categories of good and bad, right? Like a lot of the, sometimes it is literally a complete change of personality. Like the Grinch is probably the most famous example where it's like he literally goes from being evil to being good. But more often it's like the conflict changes or the characters learn some new information or what have you and they change which side they're on, but it's very rare that they become completely different people. Other than Chris, of course. Like, she's just evil now.
Yeah, so no, I don't... evil Chris for this podcast episode. Just to warn
I hope
you.
It's more dramatic than the Grinch, because he doesn't really go from being evil to being good. He just kind of goes from being a dick to being good.
The advantage to this is couple-fold, like, of why you would want to do this is, for one thing, it's real dramatic when a villain turns good, but like more importantly, it lets you put all that work you used into making the villain sympathetic and like put it to work for you, so it doesn't just have to leave if the villain gets beaten. And it's really nice if your audience liked that villain a lot, then they can like hang out and be friends mm-hmm. with the main characters.
Yeah, stories are more satisfying when there is big change between the beginning and end of the story, and that change can include the characters and the way they grow or the, you know, not grow. Is there like a word for...
regress?
Regress.
Well, there's the other type of... It's been pointed out to me that there is the character arc, which is sort of the standard, right? Where the character goes through some change and that's the part that's satisfying. There is sort of the other side of that, which is the character who starts off one way and is like hit throughout the story by reasons why that they should stop being that way. And then at the end, they're like, no, I will continue to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the temptation route, right?
Right.
Where it's like, you know, you get tempted, either like literally tempted or just because everyone around you is a jerk. That's like Superman's arc in the Justice League animated series. And it's a mm-hmm. very good one where he starts off being all like super cool and good. And then over the course of the series, he's like, everyone is terrible and me being good is just hurting everything. So I should probably be a jerk. And then at the end, he's kind of like, ah, I should not be a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's the other side.
Yeah. So, but a big swing is satisfying, but the bigger the swing, the harder it is to pull off because people just don't naturally change that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to have better and better development and more compelling motivations in order to get your characters to do that. And it always doesn't always turn out so well. It's difficult. Strangely, when I was looking at examples, it seems like it's more likely that heroes that turn into villains, for some reason, seem to be done a lot poorer. Did you guys notice that pattern, or is that just me?
I would have said the opposite, actually, because there's more incentive, it seems, to turn a villain good than to turn a hero bad. So writers want to do it more. Again, because writers put so much work into making their villains likable, they then want to keep them around, but you can only keep a villain around for so long, right? So before he either becomes a Team Rocket villain or has to become a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I have noticed more bad attempts to turn villains good than the other way around. Not to say that it never happened. Clearly it happens the other way too, right?
Right. But you think maybe it's because more of those arcs are happening.
Right. I just think that it is much more tempting for writers to do that. Whereas, like, a writer who has their, like, beloved hero turn evil is, at least in my mind, taking a much bigger risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, what if that was the hero that the audience liked? and now they're gone.
Right. Yeah, when I see it, it's often like a best friend character that sort of, and it's to create more conflict. But in my experience, when I see them, oftentimes it feels like it's neglected more. Like the writer or writers didn't really want to take the time to fully get into why this character went evil. And so it turns out kind of sloppy, where I feel like when there's a redemption arc, a lot of times a lot more time and effort is spent on it.
So, Chris, I'm willing to be convinced that there are more bad hero to villain changes, if you would care to explain this to me.
You know, my evidence is very anecdotal. And that anecdotal evidence is not very good evidence. But, like, okay, here's just think about this. Anakin Skywalker.
Well, actually, it's not even that it's not very good evidence. Anecdotal evidence is, in fact, not evidence. It's just a series of anecdotes.
But as I am evil, perhaps I can twist it into seeming like
that evidence. Does sound like something evil Chris would do, so I'll buy that. Okay, so Anakin Skywalker. Yeah, okay. That's
See how, like, I think that, obviously, there's lots and lots of things wrong with those movies, right? Like, we could spend the entire podcast talking about it, but I think the biggest problem is that they do not give him compelling enough... he moves too fast, too evil, without enough motivation for doing so.
That's true.
And they didn't have enough time. Like, is part of it, like, if they had spent... You know, if they hadn't wasted an entire first movie on pod races, like, they might have had time.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like they didn't have enough time. And that's what I'm seeing when I'm looking at this, is that there's not enough time and there's not enough explanation. It's Peter Petrelli.
Before we move on, you did say there's a lot bad with those movies, and I would agree to the point where I don't think any of the characters really have strong motivations for doing what they're doing throughout the prequels. Like, Anakin going from being a hero to a villain, like, doesn't stand... Yes, it's the, like, core part of the... It is supposed to be the core part of what that trilogy is telling us, but it doesn't stand out as particularly bad compared to how all of the other characters are written.
I wouldn't say that. Yes, the characters are illogical, but, like, you need extra evidence and motivation if you're gonna, like, slaughter children. Like, you know, you just, like, there's a burden of proof. Like, somebody, like, ignoring that a special power exists doesn't seem like you need as much for that to justify that as I'm gonna turn around and murder children now. Like, I think there's, like, a different level of how much justification you need for something.
It's also maybe more along the lines of, like, everything is equally bad, but the Anakin plot is more load-bearing, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think that's... And, like, you would expect someone to spend more effort on the load-bearing part of the plot, and, you know, you could maybe forgive that some of the less important elements aren't as well constructed, right? But that, you know... Clearly did not happen. I don't think any of us are going to argue that it was good, right?
But for instance...
No, wait, I have this special guest podcaster who's going to come in and tell us why Anakin's arc was done splendidly.
No, we don't have time for evil Mike this episode.
but just as a comparison, like, Anakin goes and murders sand people, and you can understand why he does that. Like, even if it seems poorly motivated, they at least give him something, right?
I suppose.
But, like, later... That's not even there. Like, there's not even a...
Honestly, like, if we're going to bring up murdering children and sand people and stuff, I have more problems with Padme's reaction to that news on both counts than I do to his motivations for doing it in the first place. But that's a whole nother story.
All right. To avoid spending the next 3 hours talking about the Star Wars prequels, because we agree that's obviously a terrible transition for any number of reasons, but to counter... with my own anecdotes about villains turning good, I present the entirety of Dragon Ball Z. Like, just all of it. There is nothing about that is not a terrible example of a villain becoming a good guy.
Are all the characters villains who become heroes?
Almost. Like, probably a majority of them, actually, by the end.
I have no comment. I've never watched it.
That's good. You made a wise choice. 14-year-old me was not so wise. but, like, I'm not, like, you know... Not majority in terms of numbers, but Dragon Ball Z is bad for a number of reasons, and one of the reasons it's bad is because, like, your importance in the plot is directly proportional to how good you are at fighting, like, to a ridiculous degree. So, by the end of the series, the only people who are good at fighting at the scale that they're fighting towards the end of the series are the original main character and all of his former enemies. Well, and I guess his son is also still around. But
that makes sense. If you continue, if it's only about fighting and you continually escalate the power level, literally in this case,
yes,
of your enemies, then the only ones who would keep up by the time you escalate to the final boss would be the main hero that levels up constantly and all of the enemies that were harder and harder as he went along.
Right.
So that makes sense. Does make it good.
Right. And it's like, it feels weird to be like looking at this because again, Dragon Ball Z is just so bad on any number of levels. But like, you know, just to pick one random example, the guy who's probably the most famous for this, although again, he's not the only one, is Vegeta, who turns good sort of over a long period. But like, they all kind of ignore that he is a mass murderer and like killed like probably millions of people. And kind of changes sides because he doesn't have any choice. He doesn't really ever stop thinking that killing lots of people is a good idea. He's just, like, also enemies with the guy that they're enemies with. And then after that, he doesn't have anything to do because he's not as strong as the main character who he really wants to kill, but he can't. And so what's he going to do now? I mean, he just hangs out with him after that point because I guess that was the premise.
So I think a couple villain to hero transitions that are similar to that but were done better is Anya and Spike and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. They both have a transition that starts with them losing their powers and sort of being forced to sort of interact and get along with the good guys because they don't have the power to defeat them anymore. But the important thing, I think, in those arcs is that later, after they spend a lot of time adjusting, they are both, like, given their powers back, right? They both have the opportunity to then turn evil with power again. And then that's kind of the test to see if they actually changed or whether they're just hanging out with the good guys out of convenience.
Although, like, Spike is able to have his cake and eat it too because he gets to have his powers back and not turn evil, whereas, like, Anya has to choose one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I found Spike's transition a lot more convincing than Anya's for, like, a number of reasons, but the biggest one is that, like, Spike has the excuse of literally being supernaturally turned evil.
Yeah, and, for sure.
Like, so after he gets his soul back, they've already established, and this has weird problematic implications of its own, but they've established in Buffy that, like, you can't be responsible thing for things you do when you don't have a soul. Like, you just can't. There's just no way to do that. Mm-hmm. So once he gets his soul back, like, you can argue that this is basically a different person. And so it's, like, not, he's not responsible anymore. But, like, Anya is still the same person. And, like, I guess she had a change of heart.
Right.
But, and, like, she still murdered lots and lots of people.
Yeah, she's still a demon, so she still technically doesn't have a soul, right?
Does she? I don't know if demons have souls or not. I forget.
I don't think they do. I don't think vampires are special in that.
They certainly don't make a big deal of her, like, getting her soul back when she loses her powers, right? She just has an amulet that breaks, and there's no other, like, hubbub about it.
Yeah, also, wasn't she originally a human who got an amulet?
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's the plot.
She was a human, but she got an amulet and she became immortal.
I think they retconned
that. She was technically a vengeance demon, though.
They said she was a demon, and then later they were like, oh, she was a human who got an amulet. And I was like, is that a demon? That's not what I generally think of a demon.
I had forgotten about that change.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that, again, if you want to, like, take everything the characters say literally, literally and read into it, you can. But at one point in time, they mention that the demons that appear for the most of the time in Buffy the Vampire Slayer are considered demons because they're more demonic than, like, people, but they're not, like, pure demons.
Hmm.
Because the mayor in season 3, he's about to turn into an actual pure demon.
Right.
And those are very much, much bigger and much more powerful and, you know,
and more
rare.
Snaky.
So,
yeah. As I recall.
Well, the particular one he was turning into was very snaky, but they were making a point of, like, no, you haven't actually been seeing or interacting with demons. You call them demons because they're partially demonic. They're not pure demons.
Okay. I was confused because of from Angel, where they established that vampires were half demons and everything else that they were fighting was demons. But I guess, you know, too much to be consistent between two series in the same world.
Yeah, this is what happens when you take everything that's said in Buffy and Angel, like, as canon, right? Like, it's not gonna fit together.
You know what else I've never seen around Sunnydale? A big honking castle. So, like, the point I was originally trying to make with all of this is that, at least for some readers, if your villain changes sides but has already done, like, things that are too unforgivable, like, that will be unsatisfying, especially because it will make me like the heroes a lot less, that they're willing to hang out with this person who did all these terrible things just because they're, like, quippy and charismatic, right? Like, there has to be some kind of circumstances. Again, it helps that Spike is told, like, has his get out of jail free card, not having a soul. Or, like, you can also have villains who have not done such terrible things that they can't be redeemed. And that's gonna, like, that will vary for every person, like, what their barometer on that is.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably do need to be careful with that. Like, even if your villain is, like, really charismatic, there are certain lines that if once they've crossed, accepting them as a hero will just be very difficult.
Yeah, the moral event horizon, as it is called.
Right, and everyone has a different place exactly where they draw that line.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, be careful with that. Like, one of my favorite crosses of a villain to a hero is in the young adult series Legends. The main character is, like, this rebel, and then, like, for a while, his antagonist is this, like, super elite soldier lady who, of course, you can tell immediately there's going to be a romance between them.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, when she changes sides, the author was careful to keep her from committing any, like, deliberate atrocities.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some of her actions indirectly lead to terrible things happening, but it wasn't anything that, like, she had intent to do. It was just because that was how the system worked, and she didn't fully understand it. And so there was, like, enough for her to feel guilty and to have that arc, but not enough for me as the reader to be like, ah, I hate her, she's unforgivable, table flip.
Yeah.
You know, which is how I deal with most of the books I don't like.
Well, if all else fails, you just have the villain-turned-hero go on wacky adventures with each of the main cast members until they've bonded with them fully.
Speaking of Zuko.
A la Zuko.
Yeah, is it time to talk about Zuko?
Zuko and Iroh. Iroh also. Like, he does it well before Zuko.
Mm-hmm. So, I was going to use Zuko as kind of an example. I would like to go over the heroine's journey a little bit, just because I find, especially for the sort of villain-to-hero transition, it's been used a lot, and it's a really good framework if you're not sure how to make your villain go in the heroic direction.
Wait, but Chris, surely you mean the hero's journey, right?
No!
No?
No, this one is only for women. No,
oh,
except
Zuko.
Except Zuko. And all the other males.
He does have long hair through most of the series, right?
but just to be clear, the heroine's journey is another mythic structure that has some similarities to the hero's journey, but it's not the same.
Yeah. And there are some people who look at it and it's like, this is a thing that's against men. No, it's not. I have a post talking about villains who use a hero's journey to become heroes, and it's all men. Any case, so I'm just going to go over real quickly using Zuko as an example, because he is the best character arc ever.
And he's dreamy, let's be fair about this.
He is dreamy.
Okay, mm-hmm. Is this evil Chris being sincere or evil Chris being sarcastic? Because I'm hearing sarcasm in the evil Chris voice right now.
So this is that, like, moment of extra conflict and tension between, like, the heroes and, like, the maybe villain to try to figure out, like, do you really trust this person?
I think you're just confusing the audience, which is actually poor storytelling.
Oh.
Maybe you should be less obscure as to whether or not you're being sarcastic.
No,
do you or do you not think Zuko has the best arc?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I was convinced, but you go on.
So, the heroine's journey depends on a duality, and usually that duality isn't actually good and evil, and whether they're good or evil depends on whether they're in balance or not.
Mm-hmm.
So for Zuko, he's got two bloodlines, and one is that he's, on his mother's side, he's descended from the previous avatar before Aang. He doesn't know that, actually, though. And on the other side, his father's side, he's Fire Nation royalty. So it's kind of the Fire Nation voice versus the Avatar in kind of a more holistic viewpoint. So one side of the duality is called the feminine, and the other is called the masculine. So it starts with them shifting from the feminine to the masculine. And the idea here is that you show the villain first, and this can be in backstory, it doesn't have to be in your current story, you show them when they were good first. Because that kind of gives you a more holistic view of the character, and then their goal is to then become good again by the end. Even if that's just backstory. So, Zuko, we have backstory showing him with his mother, and how he was a really, really nice kid, and his mother wanted to protect him. But then, in order to protect him, she had to leave. She had to run away, and he's left with his father, who is actually a really cool person. And he has to try really hard to please his father, and that's what's called the road of trials. So, they start to shift towards the masculine, away from the feminine, maybe because somebody in the feminine abandons them or pisses them off, or because there's a really alluring masculine figure that they want to imitate. So then they spend a whole bunch of emotional investment to actually earn being on this other masculine side of the duality. So Zuko really wants to please his father, and then his father like, doesn't make it easy for him, he actually banishes Zuko, and so the only way for Zuko to please his father is to capture the Avatar.
I must restore my honor! Honor!
There's definitely a lot of honor. I remember that much.
And then, once they actually finish the Road of Trials, they actually successfully become super, like, on the masculine side of the duality. They have the illusion of success. They think they have everything they want, but they really don't. And for Zuko, that's when his father, like, thinks that he's killed the Avatar, and he actually gets to go home, and his people, like, you know, praise him and all this stuff, and he's got this all these outward trappings of success. But, of course, inside, he's not happy. And so then after they get success, they go through this period called the Descent, which is basically when they have this kind of rude awakening that things are actually really not good. For Zuko, he just becomes increasingly angry with himself. Like, he knows he's done the wrong thing, even though he's been rewarded for it. And so he's just not happy and really angry all the time.
Right. And he tries to talk to his uncle, and his uncle gives him the cold shoulder, and that makes him even angrier with himself. And yeah, no, it's great. It's beautiful television. It's what it is.
And then we have what's called the meeting of the goddess, and that's their, like, realization or moment of truth. You know, when they finally are able to see clear enough to correct themselves off of this masculine path. For Zuko, you know, I think it's Iroh leaves him a note talking about his, you know, great grandfather and how he died.
Yep.
And Zuko thinks it's his, like, dad's father but it's actually his mother's father. And it's actually the previous Avatar. So he learns exactly how the previous Avatar died and that Avatar was actually his great grandfather and sort of connects with that other side of his duality again. And then after they have the moment of realization, though, it's not easy for them to go back and become a hero. They have to go through the reconciliation, which means they just go crawling back.
Is this where they go on all the wacky adventures? Because, like, you know, you got your wacky Katara adventure and your wacky Sokka adventure, and you're not wacky Toph adventure. I'm very sad about that.
Toph is also very sad about that.
Yeah, I know, right?
Toph is sad about that. I think that actually happens after Zuko's, like, transition is done. This is actually the part where he shows up in the temple, and he's like, hey, Aang, I want to teach you. And they're all like, no, you're a jerk.
Right, and he has to reconcile with them by earning their trust through wacky adventures.
Oh, what actually?
It's a long process. It takes several episodes for them all to finally accept him as part of the group.
Well, he actually burns, I think, is a Toph.
Yeah, it's
Toph. He actually burns a Toph.
Toph doesn't get a wacky adventure, and she gets injured.
Right. But that specific stage is done when Aang actually accepts him as teacher, right? Like, he has to actually hang around and refuse to leave and beg for a whole while. Then, the next part is actually the reincorporation of the masculine, because again, it's not a good evil duality. The person has to be in balance. So at this point, Zuko realizes his firebending powers are, like, all but gone. He tries to teach Aang, and the firebending is just not there, because he sort of now doesn't know how to incorporate the masculine side of the duality, the firebending, Fire Nation side, into his new life. And so then to do that, him and Aang go and learn from the dragons. I guess it is his wacky adventure with Aang.
Yep.
And he learns basically the new meaning of, like, the fire powers he has, and then does them together. And then the last is just the union, which is just some sort of representation of them being in balance again.
Right.
In this case, I think it's the very end with his fight with Azula.
Now, what I'm getting from all this is, so you could use the heroine's journey, which is a specific way to do this, mm-hmm. right? But I think maybe even the more important lesson is that in order for this switch to work, it has to be, like, properly developed and nurtured over an extended period.
Mm-hmm.
And it works so well with Zuko, like, because you can see him bounce back and forth and you understand his motivations. And, like, the fact that he does, like, a double switch, like, because mm-hmm. at first you think he's going to turn good in the second season.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't. And it's totally believable. Like, it absolutely works.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably, I think, what the final takeaway from that should be.
Yeah. There's certainly, and the framework certainly forces you to actually spend time thinking about the character and their emotional investment and their identity and all those things. And so certainly you can do that without the framework. The framework is just a tool, but it's kind of a tool that gets you critically thinking about the steps in the character's arc.
Now, see, that sounds like a lot of work, setting all that up over a long period of time, what, like 3 seasons? Alternatively, you could just introduce new characters, have them fight the old characters, and then realize halfway through the fight, oh, wait, we're on the same side.
like most superhero character introductions, particularly Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, mm-hmm. whenever they find new people that are heroes, but they don't know them, they assume they're baddies and start fighting.
Look,
that sounds like a lot less work, in my opinion.
Yes, but nobody's actually switching sides there, right? Like, the whole, like, misunderstandings is a source of conflict. Like, it works for comedies, and I'm sure that's funny, but, like, it's not there.
Oh, no, it's not played for comedy. It's played for an excuse to have the superheroes be punching each other before they're on the same team.
Because that's everyone's favorite part of superhero stories. Like, literally, that's why Civil War, the movie, exists. It's because they finally realized, oh, right, everyone's favorite part is when the heroes fight each other, because our villains are kind of boring, so we should probably just have the heroes fight. I don't know what that has to do with changing sides, but but it's definitely true. Something that you do want to be careful, though, right, is that if you, because if you're going with this very, very well-developed character switch, right, where we learn lots and lots about the character, and, like, they eventually do, like, change sides at the end or what have you, especially if they're going from villain to hero, is be careful that it doesn't overshadow your actual protagonist. It did not in the case of Zuko. But mm-hmm. if you've played, there's some spoilers here for the video game Baldur's Gate Siege of Dragonspear, which is fairly recent, so mm-hmm. you know, you can stop listening if you don't want to get a spoiler on that. It's a good game for the most part, but it has a problem where the main villain is going through a redemption arc, and we learn, like, lots and lots about her, and how, like, what her struggle is, and, like, how she's going to, like, have this problem where she eventually has to face what she's done and kind of have redemption. And I ended up feeling like the game was about her and not me. And I'm like, you know, hey, I'm here. I'm the main character. Why is none of this about me?
Not everything's about you, Oren.
Maybe it should be, though.
So did you get to, like, convert her to a hero? Did you get to, like...
I mean, I really felt like I happened to be there when she converted, right?
Right.
Like, I said the dialogue options that made her do it, but I didn't really feel like there was anything... Part of the problem is that Baldur's Gate is about a blank protagonist, right?
Yeah.
So, it's hard for them to set up a story where your protagonist does something because they don't know what kind of character you're playing.
Right.
You could be a chaotic, evil, like, thief who just goes around pickpocketing everyone. But at the same time, like, when she has her moment, like, when she's down, when you're down in, like, in hell, and, like, literal hell, and she has her moment where she's like, oh, I've been misguided this whole time. Like, I need to turn back to the path of light. I was kind of like, or you could not. I don't really care which one you do at this point, you know.
So long as you keep fighting on my team.
It sounds like she transitioned partly in cutscenes, and yeah. like, because she was a big center of the, like, main storyline.
Also, like what Mike mentioned, is staying on my team. Like, I was doing fine without her, frankly.
Right.
Like, the boss fight is not that hard. And it's like, I'll help you. And it's like, or I got this. You know, it's fine. And that's not a problem.
I've stocked up on potions. We don't need another party member. We're good.
I'm max level. I've got my shaman dance all figured out. Everything's great. No. So, like, that's not a problem for prose fiction writers, because they can make the fight as hard as they need it to be, right?
Yeah.
Although I have actually seen this as a problem with some prose writers, where the fight feels really easy when it's supposed to be hard. But it's not for the same reason. In your prose story, if the villain is so important that they're overshadowing your actual protagonist, then maybe your story is about the wrong person.
Yeah.
Maybe you should just drop the protagonist entirely and have your story be about the villain and their journey to become a good guy.
Yeah, certainly.
Like, that's probably what I think is your best option if you are that invested in that character.
Yeah, I mean, Avatar: The Last Airbender just should have been about Zuko.
No. Toph. It should have been about Toph.
More Zuko. Let's talk about Snape.
Do we have to? Every time we talk about Snape, I get yelled at. Like, literally, every time.
Look, I'm just waiting to, like, poke all those Snape fans.
But what are you talking about? He's on your good list. You like Snape.
The Snape fans have gone after me before, okay?
Yeah,
like,
well,
they're not entirely happy with me.
She doesn't love Snape enough.
I don't love Snape enough.
Yeah, okay, fine. I think Snape's a bad example, because Snape doesn't ever actually change. He just has to stop being a Death Eater because he's mad at Voldemort for killing a woman he wanted to have sex with. And some people say that he loved Lily. I don't think he did. I don't think you can call his, like, weird obsession love. But even if you do want to call it love, okay, Voldemort killed the woman he was in love with, but he's still evil. Like, he's still a neo-Nazi. It's like, you know, it's like how we sometimes turn terrorists on their boss because their boss did something they didn't like. They're not terrorists anymore, okay? They're just terrorists working for us now. That doesn't make them good people. They haven't actually changed. And that's basically Snape's arc, is that now he works for the good guys because he can't go back to the Death Eaters because, like, you know, Voldemort's still in charge of them. And he can't do anything else in the wizarding world because he used to be a Death Eater. So Dumbledore just kind of has him over a barrel, and he'll just do what Dumbledore says. But he's still an ass.
He does seem to be friends with Dumbledore, though.
Yeah, well, Dumbledore...
He doesn't actually want to kill Dumbledore.
Yeah, because, like...
Like, he really doesn't want to kill Dumbledore.
Yeah, because once Dumbledore is dead, like, his protection is gone.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's it.
Maybe not.
I'm not sure that's it. Like, again, if it's not clear, you know, he's not a viewpoint character. Like, you kind of have to read into it.
Yeah, look, terrorists and neo-Nazis have friends too, okay? Like, the fact that Snape is capable of having a friendship doesn't redeem him.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of really, really terrible people have had friends.
Sure. But at the same time, like, you can see how the murder of Lily might have been shocking to him enough to realize that maybe even if he is a pureblood supremacist, he shouldn't be murdering people. Like, there's at least degrees.
I saw no evidence there. Of this. Like, yes, I could see that happening. I could see him being like, oh, I'm really into this, like, wizard neo-Nazi cult. And then it turned out, oh, and then the woman I loved was killed, and that forced me to reevaluate my beliefs. I did not see any evidence that Snape had actually reevaluated his beliefs. Like, he doesn't actively kill people anymore, because he can't get away with it, but just the way he acts towards, like, he still is an active proponent of Slytherin, which is nothing but a wizard neo-Nazi factory.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, all Slytherin does, is produce wizard neo-Nazis. And he's, like, all... He's gung-ho on that. And he is a huge dick to every other student who is not from Slytherin and, like, actively tries to hinder their education and is also a jerk to an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because he didn't like that orphan's dad. And it's like, oh, no, he was bullied by... I was bullied by lots of people in school, okay? I'm not hunting down their kids and being jerks to them.
You know, I have to say, like, for some of the books, you could explain it as that he's playing a role because he still has to pretend to be a Death Eater. But at the same time, like, in the beginning, they don't... Voldemort's not around, right? They don't know that he's a threat anymore. So Snape has no, like, reason to pretend to be a jerk. And he is a super jerk anyway. So that's probably a pretty good point. I think the way that was set up is something that at least you could use as a proper motivation for a villain to become better.
And I've been quiet through all this because I've had this conversation in length with Oren.
Yeah.
To the point where I think multiple times, so I'm just not interested in rehashing it. But you said most of the things that I would have said, Chris.
We could do some Facebook archaeology if you want. Mike and I have spent a lot of words on this.
Yes.
Jeez, I didn't realize. Okay, well, that's fine.
That's why I've been sitting here laughing.
We don't have to keep dredging up old pains between you two.
No, I think we do. I'm pretty sure we're at, like, what is this? The reconciliation phase, I think, if we were on the heroine's journey right now.
So we should go on a wacky adventure.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Okay, Evil Chris, you have the rest of the podcast to yourself. Oren and I are leaving.
Whee!
Okay, guys, I think we should talk about my favorite characters, like Zuko and... How about Bellamy? Bellamy in the 100.
I also hate him. I also want him to be dead.
Yeah, so the 100 is interesting. I the third season goes downhill, but I like the first two seasons a lot, and Oren decided to stop watching during the first season because he hates my favorite character.
That was one of the main reasons, yes.
Look, it was the beginning of his redemption arc, okay?
I don't want him to be redeemed.
Oren, you should know by now that you can't judge a specfic series by its first season.
Well, that's true. You know, thanks TNG. But, I mean, I have limited time, okay?
And, like, 90% of specfic series out there, especially the ones that end up good.
No, I found this especially hilarious because Bellamy is a villain at the beginning of season one, and I didn't like him in the beginning either because he was a villain. But, like, Oren got pissed off when they started making him sympathetic, right? Like, no, I can't.
This
is like a normal part of the storytelling to make the villain more sympathetic.
I would qualify. I got pissed off when I saw them trying to make him more sympathetic. He did not make, he never became more sympathetic to me.
Okay. Fair enough.
Part of that is because, okay, so this is the thing, and I see a lot of authors do this. This is not limited to just Bellamy, right? Is they're like, hey, this character did some really terrible things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then they try to balance that by being like, yeah, but he's got good sides too. And it's like, so does everyone, okay? Mm-hmm. You cannot find an evil person in history who did not also have good sides, okay? If you want them to be more sympathetic, you have to show me that they maybe regret what they did, or that they have changed and wouldn't do it again, or something. You can't just be like, oh, but he was also nice to his sister back when they were on the space station, right? It's like, yeah, whatever. World dictators are nice to their dogs and their kids. Like, that doesn't make them less awful.
I don't know. I think for most people, showing the good sides of a villain will make them more sympathetic.
Yeah, like, not that entirely. Orin is immune to this trick of psychology.
But at the very least, it humanizes them, right? So they don't seem like an evil, like, cardboard cutout anymore.
Look, just like, at any time a dictator, like, from some country is, like, finally overthrown and murdered, just, like, look up how nice they were to some people, all right? And then also how they tortured and murdered lots of other people. And then, like, tell me that that somehow made it more sympathetic, that they were, like, evil murder men, that they were nice to some people, that,
well,
they had some positive traits.
It does make them more sympathetic. It doesn't mean, like, what they did was wrong, and I'm not sure there's something problematic about making your, like, evil villain sympathetic. I don't think you're, like, endorsing fascists if you do that.
I sort of think you are. Because that's the thing, is that, like, you're treating this villain like they're someone special because they have some kind of positive traits. When in reality, we all have those. That's just a standard human thing, right? And if we were to start, like, questioning whether a person was good or bad just because they had some positive traits, or, like, even some negative traits, frankly, then, like, we have nowhere to go from there, right? Like, we're incapable of making any kind of judgments at that point.
Well, I don't think that making your villain sympathetic doesn't necessarily mean that you're, like, condoning their bad actions, or saying that they're okay, or even saying that they're special. It means that you know them as a more complete person. And just knowing somebody really well does, like, increase attachment. Like, it increases reader attachment to the character without necessarily condoning their bad actions. It just makes them human.
You are correct, like, except for with me.
Yeah. I actually would agree at least part of Orin's core point with this. An example being Darth Vader. Yeah, he turns good because he likes his son more than he likes the murder emperor who is actively murdering his son. And right. So he betrays his master and saves the good guys for us. But then he, very fortunate for him in the story, immediately dies afterwards. And so he never has to deal with the fact that he has committed countless atrocities, murdered probably millions or billions of people, either through his direct actions or issuing orders. And he never has to make the decision to actively keep fighting for the good guys against the bad. He just gets to die having done his heroic redemption. But, like, his heroic redemption was because he loves his son, which is, yes, everyone pretty much loves their children or some family member.
Yeah.
Although, let me tell you, for 5 hours, about the weird stuff they get into with Darth Vader in the extended universe.
Well, here's what I think about this when it comes to, like, sort of themes and messaging. If we're going to start, you know, making our stories, if we want to make our stories less violent at any point, if we don't want to just condone violence as a solution to everything, we also have to show that
Is the good Chris coming back?
Yeah, what happened to evil Chris?
I think good Chris is starting to take hold again.
I think good Chris is at her.
Evil Chris is earning your trust.
Oh, no. Okay, evil Chris, tell us why you are suddenly opposed to violence in our stories.
I'm not saying I'm opposed to violence, but the point is that if the good guys, since you guys are good guys, you must not want violence in your stories, or not in all of your stories. If we're going to promote non-violent solutions to problems, I think a big part of that is making it so that the villains aren't just people that's okay to slaughter because they are portrayed as subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are people too, right?
That's true.
And I think that's kind of an important part of this.
That's true. I am all for portraying villains as complicated people, right? That just doesn't make them more sympathetic to me.
Okay.
Like, I think that makes the story better because, again, it avoids the problem of, like, if anything, it's weird when the villains are not that way. When, like, they pretend that the villains are all evil all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that weirds me out a little bit. But, like, I'm not willing to accept that a character who has done something terrible, like, that I should hate them less because they also have, like, positive qualities. Like, I will hate them less if something happens that mitigates what they've done or, again, shows that they are less likely to do it again, right? That's like the core of a redemption for me. That's why Zuko's redemption works so well. Because even though Zuko has done some bad stuff, like, A, he never crossed the morality of End Horizon.
Yeah, Zuko never really did anything that bad.
He, like, wrecked some villages and stuff. but, like, you know, and but, like, I mean, okay, fine. Azula. Okay. Azula has a redemption arc in the comics. Okay. And I actually accept it. And it's not because it makes the bad things that she did okay, but it gives me a feeling that she is less likely to go out and do them again, right? Like, okay. She has actually changed. And that doesn't, again, that doesn't, like, do away with the things that she's done, but I'm more willing to accept that she has, like, that she is, there's been some justice from this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Whereas, I just, maybe if I kept watching, I would have gotten that from Bellamy eventually, but from where I was, when I stopped watching, I was like, I don't see Bellamy as any different, I just see, now that we're showing that he has a slightly, he has another side that we hadn't seen before.
Well, I mean, that's the, so they start his redemption arc there. Like, they start by making him sympathetic, then he actually goes through the whole remorse stage. But that's how they kick it off, is with that flashback episode showing, like, his relationship with his sister. Then they ruined it all of season 3, of course, by Bellamy just, like, kind of inexplicably, like, becomes an antagonist again, and, like, again, when I was talking about feeling like hero to villain is always done kind of sloppily, it was once again an example where they barely spent any time looking at his motivations for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt, and a lot of people were really unhappy with it.
Yeah, you know, Chris, I actually might have to change and agree with you. I think it might actually be that you were right the first time, which is that hero to villain is generally done worse. Because now I'm looking at my notes, and I realize most of my examples of villain to hero that was done badly are all from Dragon Ball Z. Like, not all of them, but most of them.
You just spent all of your research time rewatching Dragon Ball Z for this podcast.
Evil Chris has successfully convinced them that anecdotal evidence is a thing.
No, I'm not convinced.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
However, Oren was easily swayed because he came in here with so much anger from having rewatched all of Dragon Ball Z just so he could do this podcast, which was a very odd decision on his part.
Look, I make strange life choices, okay? Again, if you give your character a very powerful motivation for doing, like, the things that they do that are bad, especially if they're, again, if they're turning from hero to villain and potentially back again, you will make them more believable if they have some kind of very overriding motivation that can make a person be like, yeah, I don't know what I would do in that situation. And the one that I'm thinking of right off the top of my head is Londo from Babylon 5, who is, in my opinion, one of the greatest characters in all of sci-fi, and, like, kept me watching Babylon 5 even when I didn't like anything else that was happening.
Mm.
Londo's character arc, because Londo starts off as, like, basically a, just a dilettante, right? Like, he's an ambassador in, like, the most technical term, right? He basically doesn't do anything. And his whole thing is that, like, nothing matters because Centauri is a backwater now, it's not a real power, no one takes us seriously, so I'm just going to party and get drunk. And he's got the whole, like, the only thing worse than a poor man is a poor man who was once rich theme going on.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's not poor, but he's like, he has no spirit left. But then, like, he starts to see, like, a chance that, like, Centauri could be great again. And I'm not a very nationalistic person, right? Like, in general, I don't really care a whole lot about the standing of my country in the ranks of geopolitical power. But, like, Londo clearly cares about this, and it's a huge thing for him. And, like, then he gets into his point where it's like, he's almost there, he's almost got what he wants, but he just needs to, like, break some of his convictions to get it. And you're like, yeah, he's so close, you know, just, like, reach out and grab it, and then he does.
Right, you're rooting for him, even if you don't necessarily agree with what he's doing.
Right. And, like, because he has this, this incredibly powerful drive, it's easier for me to accept later, because he spends a lot of the show basically as a villain, doing all these bad things. It's easier for me to accept later that when he kind of sees where that drive led, and, like, what the results of it were, that he would be like, oh, I've made terrible decisions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even immediately upon seeing the results of his decisions, he has regret for the negative effects of what it means to bring Centauri back to power.
Like, yes.
The destruction of the Narn homeworld, he witnesses it and he is clearly not pleased, mm-hmm. but he's been driven to that point because he sees it as the only way to return his people to their former glory. And then the guilt just eats away at him for like two or three seasons.
So anyway, my overarching point on that was, if you make someone's motivation strong enough, an audience is willing to forgive a lot of what they do. And again, like showing that he didn't, that he also regretted them, even in the moment, even if he was willing to go along with it just because the stakes were so high.
Yeah. And the problem I'm seeing with all these like descent arcs is that there's just not enough, compelling enough motivation provided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like especially in, again, using a video game, they do this a lot in video games, I've noticed. In Mass Effect 2, the elusive man is not a hero exactly, but you get the impression that he is at least on his own side, right? Like, he is...
He's still not a terrorist, Orin.
I mean, he is a terrorist. Like, he's definitely a terrorist. Don't get me wrong, he's a bad person. But he has, like, his side that he's on, right? In Mass Effect 3, he has basically gone full dark side for no real reason, because he starts off Mass Effect 1 being, like, a human supremacist, right? Like, that's his thing. Is that, like, humans...
Yeah, I thought he was mind-controlled.
Yes, that's the part that gets weird, right?
Yeah.
Is that he's apparently been mind-controlled, and they're like... But that's, like, how did he get mind-controlled, first of all? That's, like, there's, like, a serious question. Of
that's
like...
actually really easily answered. He's been trying to steal the Reaper tech since Mass Effect 1, and they established in 2 and doubled down on in 3... Exposure to it, even small amounts for research purposes, ends up indoctrinating people.
Right, but he's not doing the research himself. Like, they established that you have to be in proximity to be indoccinated. So unless he, like, brought a bunch of stuff into his office, and
or
he
visited his facilities a lot, maybe?
And he knows how indoctrination works.
Right.
Like, there's no reason he would do that, is the problem. But then, like, it gets weirder, because if he is the victim of mind control, again, that would kind of make him a victim.
Yeah.
But Mass Effect 3 really plays up the angle that, oh, he's just that evil. And, like, wait, is he a mind control victim, or is he that evil? How did he get mind controlled in the first place?
I had a feeling of hoisted on his own petard with that story arc. Like, he has fallen victim in the same way that Saren did in Mass Effect 1, but it was really, like, he chose that path that put him at risk of that happening. And the path he chose, even if he hadn't fallen victim, was pretty terrible. So I wasn't too sympathetic for him.
Like, with Saren, I thought that it worked a lot better. First of all, for most of the game, you don't know why Saren is doing what he's doing. You just know that Saren has turned super evil for some reason. And then when you do find out, I think the game is a lot clearer that Saren is a victim. And even, like, your dialogue with him at the end, I think, reflects that. Mm-hmm. Whereas I really felt like Mass Effect 3 was basically just a whole game condemning how evil the Elusive Man is for siding with the Reapers, even though he apparently was mind-controlled to do that.
Right. Didn't have a choice.
And it's like, not like he didn't have other things they could have condemned him for, right? Like, he was a human supremacist terrorist leader, right?
Yeah.
He did bad stuff. So it felt insincere to me. It felt like they wanted him to be the villain, and they weren't really too clear on how they got him there.
If you play with petards, eventually you're going to get hoisted on one.
since we're almost out of time here, I just want to take a quick moment to shout out to my two favorite Cardassians, who both go through this arc, Damar and Dukat.
Yeah.
Dukat's great, because he, like, goes from being a bad guy in the first season to, like, a good guy later when they start fighting the Klingons, and becomes a bad guy again when the Dominion shows up.
Yeah, he's a really good example of what you're saying about, like, is the villain actually a good guy now? Did they actually learn their lesson? Are they actually not going to do it again? Or is this just a relationship of convenience, right? And Goldicott is a really good example of that.
Yeah. Lots of examples that we've used of characters who use the revolving door, going back and forth between good and evil.
Right. And the thing about Dukat that's nice is that this is something that the characters, like, even, like, Kira kind of warned us about this when Dukat was, like, first on their side, because Dukat's very charismatic, right? Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, the audience kind of wants him to be on the good guy's team, and, like, it's kind of easy to accept in season 4 when he becomes a straight-up good guy for a while. But, like, Kira doesn't accept him, because Kira remembers all the terrible things he did, and Kira even says that she doesn't think he's changed.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out that she's right. He hasn't changed. He was on their side because it coincided with his goals to be on their side.
Yeah, Goldicott is really interesting because he's a villain, through most of it, but sometimes a hero who just really needs outside validation, mm-hmm. like really badly.
Especially from Sisko.
Especially from Sisko. Also from Kira.
Yeah.
Like, he really wants that sort of validation. And so he's persuaded to be good for a while so that he can get it. But, like, ultimately it's shallow reasons that he's doing things and not, like, because he actually wants to do the right thing.
I'm doing these good things. Why don't you love me now?
And it's so rare to see that villain character who wants that kind of validation.
Yeah, his whole arc is like, why don't the Bajorans love me for all the things I did? and it's terrible and scary, but amazing.
He really wants to be Schindler from Schindler's List, and he's... Even though he's not at all, he really views himself that way.
Yes, to an extent, I agree. I definitely agree. Damar, on the other hand, actually does go through a legitimate change.
Yeah, Damar doesn't care what anybody thinks, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and his standards.
To a certain extent, I mean, Damar never really liked the Dominion, like, from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, he was going along with it because of what Dukat wanted. Damar's change isn't, like, thinking that the Dominion is wrong, but, like, getting the spine to do something about it is Damar's motivation. And, like, to a certain extent, he also even, like, he starts off having nothing but contempt for Kira, but by the end, he actually kind of not only respects Kira, but displays some remorse for, like, what was done to the Bajorans. Not a lot. He doesn't talk about it, but mm-hmm. it does come up once or twice.
Yeah.
And again, like, Damar is he kind of has the opposite direction of Dukat, right? Whereas Dukat never actually changes. He just finds himself in different situations. Damar is in basically the same situation for the entire, run of his arc, and he does change.
Yeah.
And so those are two, different examples, but both very successful from the same show and both Cardassians. So, you know, I thought that would be a good example.
Yeah.
Of how you can do it.
Mm-hmm. So do you guys have a really good example of a hero turning evil?
A really good example of...
I was struggling with that. That was my problem.
Really good example of a hero turning evil.
I found several that I really enjoyed, but it's typically things that, like, spoil a really major piece of the story, so I don't want to just throw them out as a spoiler alert, here's the plot of this as an aside, so I'm going to keep quiet for that.
Well, we're nearly at the end, right? So I feel comfortable putting a pretty big spoiler warning here, because there's not a whole lot left if you don't want to hear the spoiler for season 4 of Legend of Korra.
Oh, that would be a good one. Yes. Yeah, okay. So turn off now if you don't want that spoiler.
Right.
I forgot all of mine because I didn't write them down, but...
Yeah, no, okay. That's a good one. Okay. Let's talk about that
so
one.
Season 4 of Korra, which is, in my mind, the best season of the show, and one of the better seasons of Avatar in general, the main villain is Kuvira. And she is actually introduced in Season 3 as someone who's helping them take down whatever Air Monk name was. The Red Lotus guys.
Yeah.
So she's helping take them down, right? She's a soldier from the Metalbending City.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't get a huge amount of development there. She's mostly just, like, efficient and useful. And then over the course of the season 4, despite the fact that they don't have a lot of episodes to work with and that they had to turn one of them into a clip show because they were suddenly out of money because they were told they had more than they were actually given.
So despite
having to take one of their episodes and turn it into a clip show, they very effectively bring her from the Great Uniter, as it were, where she is fixing the problems of the Earth Kingdom that were set up in season 3 with the fall of the Earth Queen, and how, like, you know, we see how bad off the Earth Kingdom is, right? It's not a made-up problem. It is very real.
And she gets really angry because her mentor, or is it her mother?
Her
mentor, basically, she feels like her mentor isn't doing what she should be to fix the problems.
Yes.
Yeah. And, like, there's famine, there's raiders pillaging villages, like, people are in a very bad way throughout the Earth Kingdom.
Right. All the problems you get when you combine natural disasters with a lack of central leadership. Over the course of the series, even though, like, she doesn't actually change because she's basically been set on her course from the first episode, as the audience, we don't know that yet. And we first see her as the Great Uniter and, like, as someone to be admired. And we start to get a little bit of a weird feeling when we hear what she kind of thinks of the guy who's going to be the new Earth King. But, like, we also don't particularly like him either. At the beginning.
Like, she has reasonable criticisms of the Earth King, the Earth Kingdom, right?
Yes.
Like, he's not experienced in leadership. He's not gonna know what he's doing.
Right. And so when she finally does turn, again, like, you can see why she did it, right? Like, you can see how the Earth Kingdom is not only in trouble now, but, like, historically, for, like, has been used as a punching bag by the Fire Nation for 100 years. And then, like, to cap that off, the big solution to the end of the war, when the Earth Kingdom was screaming for justice, was, oh, by the way, Earth Kingdom, you have to give up a big chunk of your territory to this new country we created.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, I hope you feel good about that. And, like, when I first read the comic where that happened, I was like, is the Earth Kingdom really okay with this? Like, this sounds like something that would leave a pretty deep scar, and then it turned out, no, they were not.
And I wish they had kind of gone into, because the arc is kind of like, she looks good, but she's still sort of evil at the beginning of season 4, or bad. I mean, evil's probably going too far for this character. And it's sort of revealed. It'd be nice to see more of her sort of desperation. They just didn't have time. Mm-hmm. At the end of season 3, that leaves her to sort of go down this path. But you can definitely imagine that it's a sense of, like, outrage and helplessness and anger at her mentor for not doing anything. Dakka decides that she has to take everything into her own hands, and then she becomes kind of, like, too controlling.
Yes.
And she cares about consolidating her power and having everything the way it should be and can't, like, let go.
And is a beautiful, like, because you know how the Fire Nation, right? Like, their whole thing was that they were out of balance and they were embracing the destructive nature of fire too much, right? Mm-hmm. That was their thing in the first season. Kuvira is in the same problem. She is embracing the static nature of Earth too much, where she's mm-hmm. like, everything must be exactly so, and I will smash anything that doesn't fit into that.
Mm-hmm.
It works so well with the elemental theming of Avatar. And, like, I was still sympathetic to her by the end. Like, I wanted Korra to win. Like, I was finally rooting for Korra after 3 seasons of not liking her. I was finally rooting for Korra. But I was like, I feel bad for Kuvira. Like, Kuvira is, you know, a person in a very difficult situation who made the wrong choice. Like, definitely. It's not like, you know, she is blameless. But is in a situation where, like, you know, I could see myself maybe making that choice if I had magic earthbending powers. Yeah, I right. don't, but, you know.
and if, you know, the situation had been slightly different, not during the fourth season, but in the years leading up to it, and different choices had been made both by her and the other political leaders, like,
mm-hmm.
you could see her goal actually leading to a constructive end.
Right.
But because she couldn't get the constructive end, she went for the rule with an imperial fist.
Right, route. And I would argue that the final, like, the capstone on Kuvira's arc that makes it work so much better than the previous villains did was that they actually address her grievances. Because the Earth King, or the Prince Wu, I think is his name,
mm-hmm.
when they're like, okay, we defeated Kuvira, it's time for you to be the Earth King now, he's like, actually, I don't know how to do that, so I'm not going to. And we're gonna establish a new system of government that isn't an absolute monarchy where, like, some, like, crazy person can just ruin everything, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, that actually addressed some of Kuvira's concerns, and, like, in a way that showed that the heroes were taking her seriously in a way that I didn't feel was in any of the previous seasons. So, anyway, that's Kuvira. You should make her your villain, I guess. That's what I'm saying out of all of this.
Or your hero.
Or your hero. Oh, yeah. Ooh. I like it.
Well, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to end it now so we can hopefully get good Christine back for our next episode in a couple weeks, maybe.
Yes, maybe. Okay, I swear this is good, Chris. If you want to thank us, you can leave us a nice review on iTunes. If we at some point have helped you with an important piece of creative work that you were toiling away on, you can also become one of our patrons.
All right, otherwise we will see you in a few weeks. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around, tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening and closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.